This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. Taxes was getting frustrated by your forms. Now Taxes is uploading your forms with a snap, and a TurboTax expert will do your taxes for you. One who's backed by the latest tech, which cross-checks millions of data points for absolute accuracy, all of which makes it easy for you to get the most money back guaranteed. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Now, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver, and this is the show that looks at business and politics on a wider perspective. And coming up on the show, the green lash, is the world turning against environmentalism? Is Germany going kaput? We talk to German economics and politics ahead of this weekend's elections. Plus, what on earth is bubble tea and why is it being listed on the stock exchange? You can, of course, email the show at takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, the decimation of the Green Party here in November is not unique at all. In a recent column by my next guest, she chose the phrase greenlash as her word of the year as she examined what is really a global retreat from progressive environmental policies. It's great to welcome that guest. It's Paulita Clark of the Financial Times. We are very welcome.
Hello, Eamon. It's great to be here.
Now, listen, we had, I don't expect you to be up to date on the ins and outs of Irish politics, but the Green Party had a bad day in their election here, and we've seen this happening in other places as well. And you've bracketed this up as a general phenomenon called a green lash. Can you just give me an idea of just what you're talking about and what it involves?
Yeah, so it really wasn't that long ago that we saw in countries around the world a number of governments bringing in quite interesting and effective or potentially effective climate policies or policies that were supposed to be cutting emissions. And as those policies started to be introduced, we saw in a number of places that there was a lot of opposition to them. Notoriously in Germany a couple of years ago, when the government tried to decarbonize home heating, there was a huge backlash against heat pumps and other types of technologies that the government was trying to encourage, to the point that it really led to a huge surge in support for the populist far-right AfD, which, you know, here we are in now in 2025 with an election due there, and they're number two in the polls. And their support really began to surge as a result of these policies. And we've seen this sort of pattern occurring around the world where as governments move from just setting net zero targets or climate change targets and actually trying to implement the policies to meet those targets, they're running into quite a bit of opposition.
Now, could we just dive into the layers a bit more? Obviously, you probably have a bit of a spectrum here. You've got people who are, I suppose, mildly discomforted by having to change their heating system at home, right over to people who are climate change denialists who don't accept this process is happening at all. So could you just talk to me a little bit about sort of maybe the spectrum in there?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it's quite a complex picture, really. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, it's hard to say that there is much of a green lash when you look at, say, countries like China, which are just pouring money into green energy to the point that they're now selling so many electric cars that it's starting to affect demand for oil. But then, you know, you look at places like the US, for example, where Mr. Trump is trying to roll back a number of policies that his predecessor brought in, noticeably the Inflation Reduction Act, which was designed to really boost the use of green technologies and green energy. It's really, I think, for a number of parties, for the Republicans in the US, in Germany, Austria, France, and elsewhere, populist parties have been able to exploit concerns that people have about costs in a period in which, you know, there's a lot of concern about cost of living pressures. And the fact that some of these policies came in just as inflation started to rise to really quite high levels, in part because of the war in Ukraine. But I think that the sort of mixture of all of these forces has led certainly to a situation where we're really not in the same state that we were 5 or 6 years ago, where there was far more popular support for green policies.
And do you detect that it's, you know, obviously this, when we talk about society, it's a huge multi-tentacle thing, but do you detect this among certain age groups, certain economic groups, or where would we find this green lash? I mean, obviously, we've always been told conventional wisdom is that environmentalism is more broad-based among younger age groups, less so among older. But I detect from what you're writing here, it may not be quite as simple as that.
Well, the interesting thing, I think, is, and the thing that upsets or concerns a lot of green policy experts is that in countries like Germany, very young people went from voting for the Green Party to voting for the AfD, just like that. And I mean, they really, for whatever reason, they felt it was a reasonable thing to shift their votes in that way. I don't know that we're going to see quite the same sort of shifts, say, here in the UK. It's quite difficult to imagine Green Party voters going for, say, the Reform Party. And in Ireland, I think, again, you know, there were a whole set of political pressures there that, were quite unique probably to Ireland. So I think it's difficult to really say that there is a uniformity to this movement. But I think if to the extent that there is any kind of overweening factor that's at work here, it is that people have been feeling cost of living pressures, inflation, concern about whether their kids are going to be better off
And Polita, could I put another, and this is just pet theory on my behalf, so you feel free to shoot it down, but for the sake of the conversation, I'll put it to you. Is one of the possible explanations of all of this co-option of the policy, in other words, all the parties, well, okay, take out the Republican Party in the US, but generally here in Ireland and very fair degree in the UK as well, and France, the mainstream centrist parties have kind of grabbed a fair few green policies. They've greenified themselves. Now, people don't necessarily think it's entirely authentic all the time. But they, in other words, where the Green Party had its own little river to swim in at one point, other parties have moved in and sort of rubbed their clothing a little bit. So, yes, green parties have gone down individually, but the centre has grabbed onto this stuff. So, in other words, it's still environmentalism is out there, but it's now hidden in the centre. Am I onto anything at all there?
No, you're absolutely correct. When it comes to green parties themselves, that's absolutely what's happened, and we've seen that happening around the world, particularly by centre-left parties, and in some places, centre-right parties as well have done exactly the same thing. Yeah, they've really made it difficult for a pure Green Party to be as popular as they were before these more mainstream traditional parties decided to adopt their policies.
Now, obviously, the climate doesn't care about me. You are a green lash, so the issue doesn't go away, even if people don't necessarily want to confront it. Or do you think that it's maybe some part of this is a problem of communication? That, you know, green parties and maybe centre-left who stroke green parties, you know, they've had an issue with trying to explain their policies, make them more mainstream, make them get wider acceptance. So we're back to sort of political communication, language, control of the media, all those other issues, rather than there's anything, a kind of a green lash. There's more a green lash against specific policy communication. Is that possible? Another explanation?
I do think that Number one, we have to give all these policymakers a break because the world has never tried to decarbonize at speed before. There's never been an attempt to try to basically tear up a fossil fueled economy and turn it into a green energy driven one before. So it's, you know, it hasn't been tried before. But I think you're absolutely correct. The communication is really vital. And so I think what we're already seeing, particularly since the election of Donald Trump, is that a lot of pro-green businesses in particular are starting to talk less about saving the planet and more about resiliency and making sure that everybody has the right sorts of products and services that can deal with, say, a hotter, wetter, stormier world. So I think that message that what is being done to help the climate is actually being done to help ordinary people, and explaining that it's not necessarily an elitist plot against ordinary workers.
What? I thought it was. and you know what I was going to think also is, we're talking about the communication piece. Obviously, there's two philosophical approaches to decarbonising the economy. You can incentivise people to do it, or you could be more punitive. And sometimes I suppose you have a mixture of the two. If you look at traffic, New York has this new congestion charge. Obviously there in London, you've had it for a long time. We don't have it yet, but we are making it more difficult for people to drive into Dublin city centre. So is the issue that people are revolting against the more punitive side, but they're open to, you know, be given tax breaks to buy an EV or whatever. So again, I'm coming back to sort of how these things are served up and their political palatability.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely, 100%. That's incredibly important. And the Inflation Reduction Act, there was no, you know, mainstream opposition to that, or people weren't marching on the streets about it because it was a handout. It was tax credits. It was incredibly popular. And to the extent that, you know, it's going to be difficult for Donald Trump to roll a lot of it back, because even in Republican states, there's a lot of support for it. Unfortunately for Europe, they just can't, you know, Brussels can't dictate that every member of the European Union hands out these sorts of tax breaks. That's not how the EU works. But yes, I mean, for countries that can afford it, you know, Norway has shown the way with electric cars. It's no accident that it's got this enormous level of electric car take up there, because they basically made it so that you were an idiot if you didn't buy an electric car, because it was just going to be too expensive otherwise. So, you know, that's when you can get these policies to really become popular and be taken up. And I think those sort of policies we're now seeing, learning somewhat painfully in many places, that's the way to do this. That's the way to get it going.
Yeah, and it brings us back to your original point, but this is really a backlash against inflation, higher prices, you know, incomes getting squeezed, and you know, the green issue is thrown into that fire. So as you say, maybe if we shift a bit more onto the incentive side and say to people, you can get this if you do this, as opposed to we're going to punish you with this if you don't do this, maybe that will be more successful. And I haven't got the data in front of me to show different countries and case studies and all the rest of it, but it just sounds like, from your article at least, that might be a more productive approach.
I think that's right, just broadly, that, you know, why should we expect shareholders in BP or Shell to support their rapid transition away from fossil fuels to renewables if the share price of that company is seen to be being affected by that policy? You know, that's just not the way that financial markets work, you know. But once people can see that they're going to be making money, not losing money, then you get a wholesale shift in sentiment very quickly. It's just a matter of, as they say in the jargon in the climate world, it's a matter of aligning incentives in it.
You need a new job, Alita. You're lost to a management consultancy, lost you a long time ago. Can I ask another question, which is what might change? Obviously, you've written your article, like all articles, it's a piece in time, a snapshot. It's hard for depressed greenies listening to us and environmentalists listening to us. They might be saying, well, hang on a second, it can't be all this doom and gloom. Trump is obviously in the US. We've got a German election this weekend when we're talking just ahead of that to you. I mean, where is the sort of, if you're a Green Party supporter or somebody who feels very strongly and morally about environmental issues, is there any good news out there that you could spot for them when you were writing your piece?
Well, it's a long way away, but we do have to remember that China exists and is exerting a huge influence on markets around the world. And, you know, that they are now producing an electric car for under $10,000 that is so superior to most other cars, petrol cars costing three or four times as much. that eventually is going to really drive down prices of electric cars everywhere, I think, even in places where, in many European countries where, of course, we have tariffs that make it get more difficult. But nonetheless, I think electric cars, we can feel quite warmly about that. And the fact is that, you know, there are countries like the UK, which is a G7 country and has got this policy of decarbonising its power grid by 2030. It's a hugely ambitious policy. But if it does it, it's going to be showing the world that these sorts of policies are possible. So we shouldn't get too downhearted about.
I know. I like the idea of the headline in the FT: "Hope for Green Party campaigners comes from China." But I know what you're saying. Well, things are changing. We haven't maybe caught up with that yet.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's true. It really is. I mean, every other day we're seeing something extraordinary happening there. And, you know, globally, a record $2 trillion was invested in green energy and green technologies last year. It's just never been that high. Admittedly, a lot of it was in China, but not all of it.
Sure. So if you follow the old follow the money trick, you know, leads you to some optimism at least.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, we shouldn't be too gloomy about this, but, you know, we just have to recognise the reality, I think.
Listen, thank you very much. We'll see where we are in a few years if the green lash continues or is just a temporary thing. But for now, thank you for documenting it. That is Paulita Clark, who is from the Financial Times. This is Emmet Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we turn to Germany and ask, is it truly the sick man of...
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Europe. Now, welcome back to Taking Stock with me, Emmet Oliver. Now, Germany goes to the polls this weekend and the future of Europe may well depend on the results. It is expected that the far-right AfD party, bolstered by an Elon Musk endorsement, will do well enough to become possibly the main party of opposition. The election can't really hide that sense that Germany may have just lost its mojo. Now, to preview that election and talk about the economic health and societal health more generally of Germany, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Wolfgang Munchau, who is the author of Kaputt, The End of the German Miracle. You're very welcome, Wolfgang.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Now, listen, I just want to say a personal thing here. A few years ago, I read a book called Why the Germans Do It Best. You're telling me I'm going to have to read another one saying the opposite.
I'm afraid you do. My book says the opposite. You know, I think people have been forever, you know, trying to emulate each other's models. You know, there were lots of books in the 1980s on, you know, why Japan is the model that everybody, you know, had to aspire to, and then Japan crashed, and Germany was sort of the same in the same category. But Germany really did perform very badly since 2018. For 7 years, this is a structural slump. And, you know, there's nobody in their right mind would today say that the Germans do it better.
And Wolfgang, I mean, there's certain characteristics, and it's not just me, but lots of economists would associate with Germany. They would say strong engineering skills, efficiency, you know, good, strong management thinking. Are those things still in place, or they actually have become degraded?
They have become degraded. I mean, Germany is still an engineering country, but Germany is not a digital country. And Germany has, by and large, missed the digital revolution by sticking to old engineering. That was one side of the story. They also stuck to old companies. And it's always the same companies in Germany. Germany had great companies going into the 21st centuries, and they still have the same companies. There haven't been any, you know, large new companies joining the stock market index.
Now, I understand there's some very, I suppose, almost spooky things to illustrations here, where you have things like fax machines being still pretty prolific in the German economy. Just how you know, old is some of the technology and outdated that that pops up around the German economy in your experience?
I mean, you know, the fax machine is still sort of used by, you know, doctors' offices and large parts of the public administration. The phone network is terrible, except in big cities. There are huge gaps in the country. It has one of the lowest rates of optical fiber penetration in Europe. Schools are not really up to date on digitalism. I mean, we're not talking about kids taking their phones to schools. We're talking about really the sort of educational software engineering and, you know, programming and all that stuff. Germans are generally, you know, haven't taken well to the modern age. Angela Merkel famously said in 2013 that, you know, the internet was new territory. I think we all were on iPhone number, whatever, 6 or 7 by that time.
And obviously, is this possibly a function of how old the society is demographically? I mean, there's famous stories about driving across Germany and there's no lights on in a lot of towns after 7 o'clock because there's just no young people there. So is that part of the problem, just the demographic structure of the country?
Demographics is part of it. I have to acknowledge this. But I think this goes back much, much deeper and much, much longer when, you know, the demographics was still very different. This is a failure to invest in technologies that were not made in Germany. Germany was sort of the inventor of, you know, of a lot of classical mechanics was created in Germany. The early phase of engineering was in Germany. Germany invented the car. You know, engineering was sort of their technology, and as was chemistry. Whereas, you know, digital was an American technology, and that was something that they always struggled with. They didn't understand. They didn't have the same infrastructure, because this is the thing, the way that Germany worked. It had, you know, it wasn't just, you know, that the universities were good at engineering. It was there was university, there were institutes, there were banks that would fund it, there would be companies, there would be government that would kind of organize everything. So it was like a semi-managed economy that they didn't have that with digital. Digital was not part of the network, and so they never created anything out of that.
Now, you mentioned Angela Merkel, who's obviously also been on a book tour herself in the last 3 months. She was obviously such a dominant figure for quite a while, but was there two critical issues there? One was the outsourcing of energy. So energy for Germany was often imported from some hostile regimes, as we know, the Russian Federation chief among those. And also, it also had another dependency, which was exporting a lot of its goods, creating a very big surplus into China and other countries. So those two things, which were celebrated at the time, have now been revealed to be actually quite big vulnerabilities, which we see play out with Ukraine, for example. So did people realise that at the time, or is it just something like that where all people in Germany are kind of coming and arriving to these vulnerabilities now and saying, aha, why didn't we do something about that then? And that's kind of stained Angela Merkel's reputation.
Oh, indeed it has. And it's often like, you know, people, when they look at the economy, you know, they look at the GDP growth figures, and back in 2015 or 16, it was still good. But Germany was vulnerable. And, you know, if you have an economic model that depends on the world not doing what it did, then that's not a good idea. There is a lot of things that have shifted since that period. The Brexit was one of the first shocks, the pandemic, the Russian war, and now Trump's tariffs. This is all a sort of the perfect storm for Germany. And it's only a storm because they made themselves so highly dependent on other countries, on globalization working smoothly as it did before. This modern world is not conducive to them. And I would urge them to become more flexible, you know, to become less dependent on the same old companies, on the same old technologies, but to open up to new stuff. And that's their real problem.
Isn't that a problem, though, of timing? What you're saying there, to overhaul the economy in the way you suggest, it's not going to happen tomorrow morning, right? It's quite a long-term program. You'd have to change the output of students and the skill base of the country. You'd have to invent and create all these new companies, these high-tech Silicon Valley-style companies. I mean, that isn't going to save anyone's political reputation or future at the moment. Is that your problem there?
Well, there is certainly a time inconsistency problem. What my fear is, no, I would not expect any you know, anybody to solve the problem anytime soon. What I just do not see in Germany is anyone even addressing the problem. And if you have no one in politics, on the left, on the right, in the center, who says, look, we have to actually, you know, go to the roots of this and make ourselves less dependent, become more flexible. If there is nobody in politics, then, you know, this isn't going to happen.
Now, obviously, you had the reunification of the country in 1989, but I do see a lot of the support for the AfD comes from East Germany. I know not exclusively, but they have a big stranglehold in that part of Germany. So does that tell you that reunification in 1989, it seemed to go reasonably well at the time. There wasn't really that equalization between West and East Germany, and that's firing up a lot of what we're talking about here.
Yeah. If you go back into the history of why Germany, you know, why Germany declined, you actually go back a long time, and the time of unification was an important one. When unification happened, West Germany made sure that East Germany would not outcompete them. So they raised the wage level pretty much immediately to the West German level. The East Germans thought initially this was pretty cool because they got higher wages. But the problem was that because the productivity rates were not nearly as high, the East German economy was kind of stuck in a low. It wasn't really firing on all of its cylinders. It was dependent on subsidies for a long time. It wasn't performing very well. It had high unemployment, and that was sort of the root of much of the problem. Unification could have given Germany sort of a new lease of life. It could have introduced a new dynamism.
I'm a bit apprehensive about asking you the next question, but that's my job. So how bad could it get in Germany? Like, what are we talking here? Are we talking about a few years of subpar growth? Are we talking about high unemployment or political instability, extremism? When are we going to hit the bottom, and how bad is that bottom going to be?
It's hard to say when you're going to hit the bottom. It's going to, you know, there's a lot of scope for going downhill by quite a lot. I mean, this is a slow burner crisis. This is not a dramatic crisis. Germany is not growing. It hasn't. This is year three of zero growth. And zero growth is very disappointing, but zero growth is not a calamity or collapse. What it means is that, you know, fewer people get sort of involved. You know, people make less money than their parents, that, you know, people on the edges of society find it harder to find jobs. The parties of the far right get more support. There's more sort of more tension, social tension in the country. Generally, the atmosphere will, you know, declines, and, you know, things get harder, but it's not dramatic. So this can go on for a very, very long time. And one should not assume that just because things are bad, people will necessarily find a solution, because they might have solved the wrong problem. You know, if they think, as they often do in Germany, you know, let's raise taxes or let's cut social spending, let's cut welfare plan. That's what they used to do. This isn't going to solve the problem when, you know, when you're not flexible enough, when your products are no longer competitive. You know, Germany has a different kind of problem than it has at the point.
Now, you're saying people, the political establishment, they aren't facing up to the problem at all. Like, they're not even necessarily discussing it, even never mind trying to fix it or resolve it. So what are they saying as these elections take place this weekend? Can you kind of, apart from the AfD, and I'll come to them in a second, but the other, what you might call more centrist or traditional parties, what is their recipe for getting Germany and the German economy back on its feet? Is there any kind of new thinking or anything you haven't heard before, or is that all the same old bluster?
They all support the model. They all support the export-led industrial growth model with the same old companies. The left does it the left way. They want more public sector investment, what left parties always do. The right does it the right way. They want lower taxes. The center party has its own sort of, its own priorities. It wants more freedom, but it never ultimately, the experience was when they're in government that they never deliver that. So they all agree. The Greens want industry. They just want green industry. So everybody's basically, you know, in agreement that the old industrial model is still working, and they're trying to fix it. They're trying to fix it with their old ways. And, this election, hard to predict elections, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties this time around, but it will always almost surely result in some kind of a coalition. And it's the kind of coalition that we had before. Merkel had these type of coalitions, the main party of the left, the main party of the right, forming together a government. And that has never been a recipe for success. And I struggle to see how it can be any different this time.
And then on top of all of that, you plonk down on top of that, obviously, the election of Trump and the very strange in concert movement between him and Vladimir Putin this week, and all these catch cries for extra military spending. Some countries being asked to go up to 5% of GDP and so on. So is there any appetite for that on top of all these economic troubles that the country of Germany is suffering? The politicians' message will also be, we have to solve all these economic problems. And on top of that, a good dose of the spending will have to go on tanks and ammunition and so on. So how is that message being sold?
That message is at the moment not being sold. Except for Scholz saying 5% is too much, there's no way that Germany could stem this. The only sort of slight upside I could see here is, as sort of general industrial production goes down, Germany might benefit a little from extra defense spending, because you know Germany does have a defense industry, and if they could scale up the defense industry, that would be a pocket of defense, you know, of industrial success going forward. So I'm not saying that the future isn't sort of entirely, you know, non-industrial, but defense industry will play a role. But on the whole, this is a country that needs to get used to the fact, as everyone else, it happened everywhere else, that industry will not play the same prominent role in the future than it did in the past. And the Germans are really struggling with this.
Now, for the rest of us, and we all move slightly in a German orbit here in Europe, what does it mean for us? We obviously see Germany as that anchor state in Europe. It's obviously a leading player within the EU, probably the leading player. From what you're saying, it seems to be it's going to be taking lesser of a role. But how much of a lesser role? Should the rest of us be worried that Germany, while it mightn't leave the EU, it might be more in the back seat in future?
Yeah, I think that's what I see too. I mean, Friedrich Merz, I mean, we have to see how he will be as a chancellor if he gets elected. He promised to become a European leader. And we will see whether he has the, you know, the capacity and willingness to do this, or whether this is just talk. He has not been in power before, so this will be important. But I can see Germany not, you know, taking a back seat. France has, you know, been taking a back seat for a long time, and it leaves Europe rudderless and without Franco-German leadership. So I think the German decline matters a lot for Europe, while there are countries like, you know, the Baltic countries or Finland are doing much better. Germany is so central to the European economy in terms of supply chains, geography, the all interconnectedness, the, you know, transportation. It's going to be, you know, very difficult for the EU to do well, and whilst Germany is doing badly.
And I did say I'd return to the AfD. We've got election results, as I know, presumably they'll pour out in the early part of next week and we'll get a full picture. We obviously, a lot of people are concerned about their growth. It seems to be quite soft. Sometimes you see them up in some and down in others. So obviously there's a certain voter moving across parties and hasn't settled down yet. But how do you see them doing? And I know there's a firewall to stop them getting into government, but is that sustainable long term in your view?
Well, the firewall will hold probably this year. It's definitely not sustainable, because as the party rises, and I expect the party to rise further, that the polls have them at around 20% now. They had 10% last time. And the really important election is probably the one in 4 years, in 2029. And, you know, if they get up to 30%, they could be the largest party. And then the question is no longer, you know, whether anyone wants to form a coalition with them. It's more of a question of them, who they want to form a coalition with, because it will become progressively harder for others to form coalitions around them and against them. So I think this is a party that has I think its current electoral potential is about 30%. And you know, in a country that is so splintered with, you know, six parties, vying for seats in the parliament, that is a, you know, that would be a very, very significant political force, and that cannot simply be ignored or, you know, firewalled away.
Listen, you're not necessarily cheering us up, but you're being very honest and chronicling it very accurately. So we'll see what the election results bring up. We do really appreciate you giving us an unvarnished view of what's happening, and a more realistic view maybe than some other books that were written a few years ago. Thank you very much, Wolfgang Munchau, who is the author of Kaput, The End of the German Miracle. This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock and News Talk. And after the break, we'll be looking at the startling success of bubble tea.
I'm Cindy Lauper. My psoriasis was all over, even on my scalp, which may mean four times the risk for psoriatic arthritis. But Cosentyx works on both.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 mg dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 mg dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at Cosentyx.com or 1-844-COSENTYX. Ask your doctor about Cosentyx.
Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. My name is Emmett Oliver. You're very welcome along. Now, do you drink bubble tea? Have you ever even heard of it? Well, the drink, which originates in Taiwan, is sweeping the world and making moves not just in cafes, but on the stock market. There's a number of IPOs by bubble tea companies. One person who knows a little bit about this is Hilary Osborne. She's money and consumer editor at The Guardian, and she joins me now. Hello there, Hilary.
Hello there.
You're very welcome. Now, I might think I'm exotic when I drink a cup of chai tea, so you're just not dealing with somebody who knows a huge amount of this new craze. But what exactly is bubble tea, and why is it making both social and financial waves?
Oh, well, bubble tea, at the moment, the term covers a whole multitude of drinks, actually. Originally, it was a cold tea, probably with some milk in, that was shaken up. And so it had a froth on top, which were the bubbles. But it's morphed into something a bit more extreme than that. People started adding these little tapioca balls. So
There's a word I know. Tapioca, I haven't heard it since the late 1970s, but okay.
Exactly, I know. For those of us of a certain age, it really conjures up school dinners, doesn't it? But this is, I promise you, this is far nicer. So they originally started adding these little pearls or balls of tapioca. And but now, really, anything goes. You get them with little cubes of jelly in them. You get these little balls that are very sugary balls, and they pop, and you get this lovely juice rush into your mouth. You can get them with this cream topping, which cream cheese topping. So actually, when we talk about these bubble tea firms, we're really talking about so a whole raft of soft drinks that they do. And the ones in this country and in the West probably don't really resemble the original bubble teas. But they've morphed to suit all tastes, which is why they're so popular, I think.
Now, I mean, we like our tea here, as you might know from a long-running show about a priest called Ted. So we're big into tea here, but we tend to like it strong but bland. This is a totally different thing. So is there a social experience around this? From what I understand of it, it's mainly attracting teenagers and younger adults, but I could be wrong about that. So can you just talk to me a little bit about who's buying all this stuff?
Yeah, so you're right. I think it's got it has got a real appeal to younger people. We're talking about, there's a generation who don't go to the pub as much as people did so much in my day. And so we've got people looking for somewhere to socialise, and kind of they want to meet over a drink. They maybe don't want a coffee. So it appeals to that sort of need in people. They look absolutely amazing. So that whole trend for, you know, taking a picture of what you're about to consume, it really appeals to that. We get some really bright colours. The taro ones are purple. You know, we get some bright green ones. You get ones where you've got a fruit tea, but then it's got a syrup, a different colour. So they look really fantastic.
It's sort of looking at the photographs, it looks a bit like what happened to the coffee market, maybe, you know, when Starbucks first came along. It's kind of taking a somewhat staid category and just messing with it in non-traditional ways. Do you think that's a fair way of describing it?
That's absolutely. And you know, one of the coffee chains added it to their menu last year. But there's really not that much difference between what they're calling bubble tea and what the things like the frappes and all of those other things that have developed. So that's absolutely the case. I mean, there's clearly a real market for people who want to go out. They want to treat themselves. They'll have a drink rather than, I mean, we see lots of these now, you know, places that specialise in ice cream and desserts. But I mean, it's really that kind of thing. They're so sweet, a lot of them.
Well, I was going to ask you about the whole sugar side of things. Obviously, it's a young person's drink in the main so far, from what you say. But if it's going to pile something onto your waistline, it's going to maybe find it hard to advance further, do you think? Or are they actually reasonably healthy?
Well, I think if you go back right to the original ones, then then you're not really looking at too many calories because, you know, like you say, I spend a lot of time drinking a traditional cup of tea and you don't think of that as being very calorific. So if you're going for the original ones, and you can get those in most of the shops on the high street, But once you start adding the bells and whistles, then yeah, they tend to come with calories. So I mean, I was just having a look at a sort of standard one on the high street, and once you added the tapioca balls, like a scoop of that was 80 calories. So then if you've got a sugary drink as you start, then yeah, it's starting to rack up really. And it's, I think that's one of the things with these and some of the coffees, is that people don't really think of them in the way they think of things like a can of Coke, but actually they have a lot more calories than people realise.
Now, Hilary, obviously, you know, we're immediately all over my script here is the word fad, craze, etc., which may be unfair, but that's what I'm paid to ask those kind of questions. So obviously this has hit the stock exchange, which moving it maybe out of that fad category. So do you think this is, and I know this is a difficult question, and I know you can't give me a definitive answer, but I think you can give me some kind of answer, which is this something that you see doing in a year or two, and we'll be doing a program in a few years and go, whatever happened to bubble tea? Or do you actually see this a bit like cryptocurrencies, where it's dismissed initially but has staying power and builds a whole new industry, including being on the stock exchange? So where do you sit on that from what you've seen so far?
Yeah, well, I think if you look to Asia, you look to the countries where it first came from, it's been around for a while. And like we've sort of talked about how you can add different things to it. So it's very adaptable. You know, it can go with the latest trends and tap into them. So I don't think it's going to go anywhere fast, really. I mean, I think if the trend towards not going to the pub continues, then it is offering an alternative place for people to hang out that isn't a coffee shop. And yeah, let's face it, the coffee shops are still there, aren't they? They've sort of sprung up, and we thought that was unsustainable to have so many on every high.
And does it worry you when you see things like stock exchange IPOs coming along? Does that make you think, oh, hang on a second, that might be just a step too far, when, you know, you're seeing investors rushing in and putting money in behind it?
No, I mean, I think these particular companies that have listed, I think that they've probably still got somewhere to go, actually, because they're ones that we don't see on the high street yet. So maybe they, you know, they've got a bigger market they can tap into. I mean, I probably wouldn't go. My local high street's got about 5 or 6 shops already, and I probably, if I was a local bank, I probably wouldn't loan anyone money to set up another one.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm sure the Guardian is glad to hear that. That's you know, not where you're going to put your life savings.
Yeah. So I mean, I think there's always a sort of point, a saturation point, isn't there? But I would say that these are sort of the companies that are listing.
And you know that whole thing about the first mover is often the biggest loser, right? The first person. So I just wonder, will the initial pioneers of this, maybe some of the companies and even some of the cafe owners and so on, will they be left behind as the big corporates eventually grab onto it? Starbucks takes it, McDonald's, etc. So is the future bubble tea not really being a challenger, but back to the mainstream, and it'll just be in your local KFC or Burger King or whatever? Is that possible, where its home will reside in the future?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I at the moment, they haven't really shown that much appetite to sort of bring it in. I mean, some of them have dabbled with it on their summer menus, but no, I don't know. I mean, I think people do sort of like specialists, don't they? And specialists should be able to sort of tap into the new things that are coming and have that kind of buzz that maybe you don't get.
And I like this idea of somebody who has a tapioca warehouse who's been sitting there for the last, 50 years, just sort of walking up and down this small warehouse, and suddenly their moment has arrived based on one of the key ingredients here. Obviously, this has come from Asia. That's where it seems to have got the first rush, the first impetus. So it's kind of one of those Asian Western crossovers, isn't it? Do you think that's going to mean that, you know, it has that big kind of momentum behind it coming out of China and places like that? And in that will what will carry us into the Western cafes and so on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've still the whole sort of K-pop kind of trend is still, I mean, I'm afraid I'm not in that world at all. So I don't know.
We were going to get you on next week to talk K-pop, but you're not comfortable. OK,
I can't drop any of the names of the bands. But I mean, I think that those things are still fashionable, you know, and people, I think people are, you know, they're really curious to try new foods and drinks. And I think people are sort of very, like I say, they love anything that they can take a photo of. So I think as long as it...
And what, I'm still seeing, can you give us a little bit about the, you know, this whole bubbles and bubbles and test kits and all the rest. So it really is that extra sort of element, isn't it, that's breaking out. It's just not the drink, but putting it together, making them and so on.
Yeah. And I think they have sort of crept into it. It's a trend that's crept into other things. So you can get, it's kind of toiletries that are bubble tea themed, and you can get these kits, and they're on, I think all of the supermarkets have them on the shelves now. So that's something you can do at home. That's quite a nice look.
Now, Hilary, you don't know about K-pop, but you do know about the UK high street. It's obviously had a tough time. We hear about endless closures. Is this something that can kind of revitalise your average UK high street? I mean, maybe even just for a few years, people, as you say, have to physically meet. Zoom won't cut it really with bubble tea. But do you see this as maybe something that can breathe some badly needed life into British high streets?
I think experiences generally, and so yeah, eating and drinking, but also we've sort of seen the stuff like mini golf.
And how bad is it over there? I mean, we just see the names, various companies going to the wall, but you're there. How bad is retail and how bad is the British high street at the moment?
You know, if you walk down the high street, some days it's busy, there's people shopping, you know, there's people in the supermarkets, but then yeah, it doesn't take much to make everyone stay at home. So there were a few weekends before Christmas when we had this terrible weather, and I walked down my local high street and I thought, oh, crikey, you know, what's going on? And I mean, it is people ordering online, you know, and anything that pushes you towards wanting to stay in, it sort of works against the high street. So I think any sort of bad weather or any uncertainty, you know, any kind of train strike or anything like that, immediately people just say, right, well, I stay in, I can do it at home, and that's what they do. So it can feel pretty miserable, but on a sunny day, you know, people still turning out and wandering around and browsing. So I went into there's a big Waterstones bookshop at Piccadilly on Saturday. I went in there, it was heaving. Absolutely heaving. So people do go out but I think again that's the sort of thing where people are sort of picking things up, looking at it. It's a bit of an experience.
Well, it's a bit, yeah, I get a sense that it's going to be the new curry house, because I see in an article in your own newspaper a lot of Taiwanese people think others have mutilated bubble tea and taken it away from its origin. So it's a bit like Indian cuisine, which is there's a sort of a very particular British form of it, which is, I suppose, a bit of a distance from the original Indian cuisine. So it's interesting to see you guys sort of repurposing these foods and drinks.
Yeah, well, I suppose everything, doesn't it? Everything changes to fit what people's tastes, and we've all been brought up with slightly different tastes, haven't we? So it sort of makes sense to kind of tap into what the local market is asking for. But yeah, I do fear that it is a lot of sugar over here.
Okay, well, listen, next week we'll talk to you about the tapioca market. But for the moment, thank you for guiding us through bubble tea. Hilary Osborne is Money and Consumer Editor at The Guardian. We really appreciate you joining us on Taking Stock.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, that's it for this week's Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast first thing on Friday morning on the News Talk app, wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. You Go to Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you, of course, for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day with some bubble tea.
Taking Stock, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
I'm Cyndi Lauper. My psoriasis was all over, even on my scalp, which may mean four times the risk for psoriatic arthritis. But Cosentyx works on both.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose, and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. an increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at Cosentyx.com or 1-844-COSENTYX. Ask your doctor about Cosentyx.